The other figures I'd spied turned out to be dried corpses. Neither of us was keen on investigating further, so we left them. Torches, set in wall sconces, wound along the passage leading out, providing smoky light. A side chamber gaped halfway along it, which I did not remember. Of course, I didn't actually remember having all my stuff taken, so... We glanced into the side chamber, which turned out to be small. Two walls were stacked floor to ceiling with cubbies. Dusty bundles clogged most of the cavities, but two contained loose piles without layers of filth covering them. Jusher's metallic curve winked in my torchlight in the cubby on the left. We reclaimed our stuff. Besides my magic talking sphere, the cavity held my clothing and everything else I'd been carrying, including my pack. Despite how my clothes smelled a bit stale with sweat, it was a relief. "Everything's here," Saraja said, "including my weapons and coin. That's surprising. I'd imagine these sad old sorcerers would find whatever visitors bring them to be diverting, at minimum, if not needful. They can probably conjure all the entertainments and sustenance they need. Otherwise, they'd have died out centuries ago. Or they just hadn't gotten around to sorting through our stuff yet. We've been down here less than an hour." We returned to the passage. It remained clear, so we set forth along it, heading away from the prison. A dozen yards later, we came to a four-way intersection. One more thing I didn't remember. Crap. Torches only lit two of the ways, straight ahead and the path to the right. "Which way?" Saraja asked, her ears waggling once more. "I forget." "Sure." Waggling ears on a Kephlum. I decided might just be laughter. "Why not ask your magic cannonball?" she suggested. "Why not, indeed?" The sphere was cool and rough in my hand as I addressed it. "Which way should we go?" "To find what you seek, turn left, Maker," it replied. Jusher had never given me that title before. But time was short, and I didn't waste time trying to figure out what had short-circuited in what passed for the object's magical mind. Saraja gave me a fishy look. She'd heard what it called me, too, but didn't comment on it as she grabbed a torch. We trooped along the lightless left-hand corridor for a few minutes before worry suddenly grabbed me by the lapels. Surely we hadn't come so far after the sorcerers had ambushed us. Embarrassed, I kept my tongue for another couple of minutes. Saraja didn't. "Are you certain this is the way?" "Jusher, you heard the Kephlum. I don't recall coming in this direction." The sphere remained silent. I gave it a shake, as if that would do any good. It didn't. "Look," Saraja pointed farther along the corridor. The flickery light of her torch revealed the corridor's end. The far wall wasn't blank stone. It was heavily inscribed with symbols that danced around in an ever-widening spiral procession. They looked worn and old. "Dead end," muttered Saraja. "We'll see," I said, as I searched for the wall's name. If nothing else, I wanted to know what the symbols on it meant. The Kephlum continued. "The talisman isn't great with directions. Of course, how could it know which way to go in the first place? It has no eyes." Ignoring her, I concentrated on the wall. Symbols were slippery, changeable. They weren't like other things I'd tried to name so far. Something like heat haze rising off a highway distorted their meaning. I concentrated, and without considering whether it was a good idea, touched the wall. Immediately, the symbols jumped to clarity. Information trickled into my brain. The symbols were magical components in a system designed to allow access for certain creatures or blast into so many drifting motes of burning ash anyone who tried to get past who weren't on the safe list. For a wonder, we were already on the safe side of the passage. Safe if you didn't include the crazy soul sorcerers, anyway. Getting out, the direction we were apparently heading didn't seem to be fraught with risk of annihilation. "Jusher had it right all along," I said, and pressed the symbol that should open the way. The entire wall faded like mist, revealing a space unlike the one we'd just taken. Instead of squarely carved passages through stone, the area beyond was natural. A twisting, irregular corkscrew of a cave passage ascended via a series of flowstone formations. From somewhere far above, faint light filtered down. The way was steep and twisty. We scrambled, crawled, and shuffled sideways in silence. But with each foot gained, my mood brightened, as did the light ahead. I couldn't restrain a grin as I glanced Saraja's way. "We got away," I said. Her ears moved apart, maybe amusement, maybe skepticism, or a little of both. "You know," I said, "we've known each other for, what, 2 months, three? You're my only friend in all Ardeen." Saraja's ears moved wide apart. Skepticism, then. "Okay, okay, you're the only person I've met here who hasn't either tried to kill me, promised to kill me, or laughed when someone else did their best to kill me." She shrugged. "I suppose you have one or two redeeming qualities, but don't let it go to your head. I may one day decide I'd like to kill you." Then her ears waggled. Laughing felt good, but my curiosity was piqued. "I know nothing about you. How'd you come to be working on the Night Star? You're not like the other pirates. What's your story?" Saraja grunted and started upward again. We continued in silence for several yards. Definitely not the reaction I'd hoped for. Making friends with jackal people wasn't as easy as it looked. After another dozen or so yards of progress, she said, "That's a story I've not told before, and one we don't have time for now. The short version is that a series of bad choices brought me to the Night Star." "Understood," I said. "Sorry to pry." She paused, shaking her head. "No, you've earned the right, Carter. If we get out of this alive, I owe you that." My smile returned. "I look forward to it. But you'll have to tell me your story in return. You're hiding many things from me." "I am," I said somewhat guiltily. "Something of even more import than my own circumstance, I judge." "Yeah, that I was the author of this entire world. Saraja would find that a fascinating claim, or rather an insane one. She'd dismiss me as a lunatic on the spot, and maybe she'd be right to do so. I was a shadow of the Maker." Finally, I said, "Frankly, you wouldn't believe me." "Why did your magic ball call you the Maker?" She obviously wasn't going to let that slide. "What would you think if I told you that I've, acquired a few of the Maker's memories and lesser abilities?" Saraja didn't quite snort. "I'd say have another swallow, drunkard." "Exactly. Who'd blame you? Not me. But that doesn't change the fact that it's true. It's why you found me in the glass desert." Her ears pointed almost directly away from each other. "Right, because the Maker decided he'd like to be a pirate." "Funny." That was meant to be sarcastic. Telling her everything was probably the wrong move. "But screw it, I'm not the Maker, I told you. But I can do some of the things he could do. It's why I came to Ardeen, to stop the betrayer from breaking the walls of the world. To do that, or wake the true Maker so he can stop the betrayer, I need to get into the Maker's hall." Saraja nodded as I wound down. When I finished, she said, "Chaff. I said there was a lot of chaff to you. That tale goes beyond the boasts of a man in his cups and ventures into the realm of pure insanity. You saw me animate that statue back there after calling it by its true name. A sorcerer with a lucky spell could have done the same." I nodded. "Perhaps. You're having me on. You're an adventurer who lost his crew, that's all, one with a bit of sunstroke from too much time spent on the glass before we found you. You're mostly harmless, mostly. I sighed. I tell you what, if I ever do wake the Maker's power, I'll make you your own ship. Maybe you'll believe me then. She snorted, but offered no more rejoinders. Arguing wasn't going to convince her. The Kephlem hadn't even considered the possibility that I was telling the truth. My exuberance at our escape frayed. Indeed, now that I'd considered how fully I'd failed to achieve my objective of entering the hall, I realized I'd come full circle. Each step was a pace farther from where I needed to be. Gaining direct control over the situation required that I enter the Maker's Hall, and I'd failed. A group of demented old men and their servitors had nearly killed me and Saraja. They had killed who knows how many people in their creepy dungeon, most recently a sacrifice in place of Mevish. Mevish was an entirely separate mystery, one I didn't have time to worry about just then. But I was glad she'd apparently escaped. My plans, both those carefully laid and the ones I'd come up with on the fly, had done nothing to stem Jason Cole's mad schemes. My thoughts churned as I tried to devise a new plan. If I could appeal to the soul sorcerers on a logical level, if they could be made to understand what was actually at stake, they'd have to let me try, right? Somehow I sensed that logic might not win them over, but I had to try. Otherwise, I was just a coward. A stinking, self-saving coward. On the other hand, dying wasn't going to solve anything. Forcing myself to turn back and face the soul sorcerers wasn't an option. The urge to flee had me in its grip like an addiction. I'd already given in. We exited onto the surface of the glass desert through a crack just wide enough to wriggle through. The sun was doubled as it dipped to touch the reflective plane. The glass was hot, but its daytime furnace intensity had already faded. Behind us, the great shattered blister of the singing crater threw shadows hundreds of yards long across emptiness. The Night Star was nowhere to be seen. How long did Timon say he'd wait for us, I asked. 3 days. We can't have been more than one, I mused. Perhaps he had other matters to attend to. Yeah, I said, gazing around. Or maybe he was chased off. I pointed, even though I felt like curling into a ball. Saraja actually hissed when she saw the figures emerging from the shade offered by the standing shards around the crater. They'd seen us first. A group was headed our way. Here I thought we'd escape from the goddamn soul sorcerers, but no. We just walked into the teeth of their power. Although I didn't see any white apes, elderly people in robes, or golems. Instead, the strangers wore chain armor with deep blue surcoats, featuring a design across the chest, a gold circle set within a field of black speckled with stars. My knack for names breathed fresh knowledge into my brain. The symbol was the crown banner, reserved for the Queen of Hazurium. The circle depicted the Queen's implement of rulership, the Ring of Peace. Holy shit, Hazurium, I breathed. In the defunct MMORPG, the queendom was a shining land of beauty and peace, the quintessential realm of noble humanity. Everything I knew about the place was 200 years out of date. What had happened in all that time? I was about to find out. 5 figures moved to the fore as the group approached. The shortest seemed the one in charge, a woman in magnificent armor wearing a crown. A sword rode her hip, and confidence lit her face. Her name was Elendine, my talent whispered. She ruled the queendom, which was significant for some reason. Then I had it. Valentine was directly descended from my friend Mel, Melissa Perkins. The recognition made me gasp. I'd taken the mantle of the Maker. Jason Cole had chosen the incarnation of war. Alice, the incarnation of silence. Peter Sanders had become lore. And Mel had taken up the mantle of death, though mostly in name. The role she'd really preferred had been that of Hazurium's queen. Oh, the party she'd thrown. Elendine had Mel's likeness, all these generations later. The queen fixed me with her great-to-the-something-th grandmother's eyes and said, "I heard your call, Maker. I came." Chapter 30 Commitment. Elendine, Queen of Hazurium. For the creator of the world, the Maker looked rather shabby, but the supernatural call had led here. This ramshackle man was the source, she was certain. What she was less sure about was whether she should have responded in the first place. His haggard stare, torn and weathered clothing, and Kephlem companion, whose scars and flamboyant dress screamed glass pirate, made him resemble the sort of person routinely turned out of Hazurium for disorderly behavior. The man she'd just greeted as the Maker coughed. Then he said, "I'm Carter Morrison. I'm not the Maker, but..." He raised his hand to forestall the exclamation already springing to her lips. "But what he was is part of me, and this is my friend Siraja." The Kephlem pirate snorted. Elendine didn't care for what the raggedy man was implying. "What he was? I've traveled across half of Ardeen to find the Maker, not some pretender." Her statement wasn't strictly true, of course. Her mission had started as one of revenge before the call came. But as usual, anger made her tongue quick and somewhat inexact. Although the name Carter sounded familiar, not the Morrison surname, though. Carter Strange was the name she remembered from stories her mother used to tell her. Carter Strange was the name the Maker took when he traveled among mortals. Of course, if this fellow was a fraud, he'd simply incorporate those myths into his charade. Maybe he perpetrated some kind of elaborate deceit, possibly up to and including manufacturing the call to the rings. Elendine let her hand drop to the hilt of her sword. "Explain yourself," she commanded. He saw her not-so-subtle movement, as she intended, but his expression didn't falter. "I'm saying I was the Maker, and that maybe with your help I can be again. I need to get inside the Maker's hall, and to do that I need the rings of incarnation, which means you have one of the seven. If you heard my call, you must." He looked at her hopefully. Of course she didn't have the ring of her ancestors. Shame colored Elendine's face, which only made her angrier. If the Maker is dead, with only you and your pirate friend to keep the memory alive, maybe that's best. What's so important that you need to enter the hall? For all I know, you simply want to steal the Maker's knowledge. You wouldn't be the first to try and abscond with the power of an incarnation. Listen, everything is at stake. My world, and Ardeen too, and every other connected realm. Otherwise, Jason, you probably know him as War, will shatter the walls of existence and let horror consume everything. The heat that had been building inside Elendine sharpened like a spear thrust, aimed at Carter, suddenly shifted and found a new target. She screamed, "War! The betrayer, you mean, that sodden, earth-wanking, piss-guzzling thief!" The raggedy man flinched. His pirate companion, who seemed to be having a hard time with their conversation in the first place, took a step back. Elendine felt Navarre's calming hand on her shoulder. She closed her eyes and counted to five. "So you do know Jason," Carter said into the silence. "War, the betrayer, stole the ring from me. He helped me in a desperate hour, claiming that he was the maker. In my need, I lent the ring to him. Her face felt warm. Holy crap, murmured Carter, looking crestfallen. How did Jason pull off that con? Con? Ellendine frowned. Con. Short for confidence trick, a swindle. How did he fool you? She chewed her lip, debating whether to tell him or walk away. Explaining what she'd been up to, she realized, might not sound completely sane. On the other hand, this man was claiming he'd once been the maker. In the balance, who was he to judge her? Finally, she said, when the ring's power swelled recently, I decided to use it to storm the Court of Sleep and ask for release of my sister Flora, recently slain, from those who judged the dead. When the false maker appeared, I was betrayed by my hope and desperation. I'm not going to make that mistake a second time. So saying, Ellendine drew her sword. It made a shh sound as it came free, and in one continuous motion placed the point at Carter's neck. So, convince me you're who you say you are, and not just another thief sniffing after power, she said. Kephlem Pirate finally spoke, raising her hands placatingly. Excuse me, we seem to have gotten off on the wrong foot, and unless I've forgotten everything I know about heraldry, you appear to be Queen of Azurium, out for a stroll on the glass desert with a small army. That's downright peculiar, given that you're hundreds of miles from your land. Is the queen who you really are? Ellendine didn't let the sword tip waver, but gave a tight nod. When the pirate put it that way, it did sound faintly ludicrous. Saraja continued, excellent, which means I shall address you properly from now on, Your Majesty. Easy enough. This leads me to my next point. I also only just learned Carter's claim to be the fallen creator of Ardeen, and like you, Your Majesty, I found his claim suspect. So you don't believe him, Ellendine said. Why do you travel with him? That's a long and complicated story, but leave that for a moment. I said I found his claim suspect. But in the time since he suggested his mad provenance until now, I'd been considering the possibility. I've compared the claim with everything I know about him and seen him accomplish since we've been together. I've reviewed all his peculiar abilities. I'm right here, you know, said Carter, his eyes flickering between Ellendine, down to the queen's sword, and over to the Kephlem. I'm talking to the pirate, said the queen. Then, go on, pirate. My name is Saraja, Your Majesty. Go on, Saraja, and make it quick, if you please. What peculiar abilities? Abilities like how he knows the name of anything, anything at all, just by looking at it, Saraja said. Or how, once he knows a thing's name, he can command it, or change it, or even give it life. That's how he freed us from the soul sorcerers we just escaped, by animating a hollow statue to create a distraction, and I realized just now, when you showed up here calling him Maker, that those would be exactly the sort of abilities I'd expect the creator of Ardeen to wield. He might be telling the truth. The pirate ceased talking and fixed Carter with a nonplussed look, as if surprised at her own words. Ellendine stepped on the hope that flickered behind her heart. She said, fascinating. Assuming you're not simply in on his elaborate sham. It's all true, I swear it, Carter said. Then show me, commanded Ellendine. Show forth your power. Name my sword. Her weapon, a sword of power wielded during the Age of Myth, had a secret name that only she... Your sword has a secret name, which makes it harder for me to know it, but... Stop, she yelled, suddenly realizing that the man might actually succeed, and worse, blurt out her weapon's name. The blade was powered to some degree by the mystery inherent in its origin and name. Whisper it to me. Carter stepped close and said into her cupped ear, "Renswan, dear." It was forged during the War of the Fall for its first wielder, Garson. Garson slew the Dragon of Shades on its deadly edge. He stepped back. Elendine gasped. "How? No one, but I know the sword's secret name." "Apparently no longer strictly true," Saraja said. Carter looked vaguely rueful and said, "It's a knack, but I don't know how it works, and sometimes I remember things that didn't happen to me." "Then to who?" "To the Maker. Part of him is in me, which is why I think I can wake him again, or at least his tools." "What sort of things do you remember?" asked Elendine, fascinated despite herself. "Flashes of stuff I don't understand very well. Fields of combat thick with monsters and angels, of vast spaces underground, of souls being judged, and certainty. Certainty of a sort I've never felt before. As if souls being judged?" Elendine interrupted again. "Was it the Court of Sleep you saw?" "Maybe," allowed Carter, "but it's all... If I help you get into the Maker's Hall, do you promise to release my sister Flora from whatever fate she was handed by the Umber Judges? They who judge the souls of the dead? On your name as the Maker?" Carter looked confused. "I shouldn't make such a promise. I don't know how to return the dead to life." "You may not," said Elendine, hope tugging the corners of her mouth upward. "But if you can really wake the Maker, he will know. Do you promise?" Carter looked at Saraja. The pirate said, "Like Her Highness says, if you're really the Maker, then what's beyond you, or him, I mean?" Carter nodded, returning his gaze to Elendine. "If we get into the hall, and I can claim the Maker's power as my own, and after I resolve the issue of saving the world, then yes, I will do all I can to help your sister." "Glorious," whispered the queen. She glanced around to see the army of peacemakers arrayed at her back, and Navarre. The first protector's ears flicked worriedly, but for once she held her tongue. "So," said Carter, "I can point you back the way down to the spaces beneath the glass where a coven of soul sorcerers is ensconced. They're tough, but I doubt they could stand up to your army." "Why would we go down there?" Elendine wondered, her mind reviewing happy memories of Flora and anticipating the look on her face when she was pulled from death by the Maker's decree. Mumbled Carter, becoming unsure. "Because all we need do," continued Elendine happily, "is wait for the others to arrive." "The others being? If your call reached me, it reached everyone who still has or recently carried a ring of incarnation. Once they are assembled, you'll have your key. With them, you can summon the door to the hall, without need of cleaning out the vermin ensconced below." Carter looked doubtful. "You think it'll be that easy?" Elendine shrugged. "Well, of course, when the betrayer arrives, we'll have to kill him and take his ring, and the one he stole from me. I suppose other arrivals could prove similarly annoying." The first protector finally broke her silence. "Your Majesty can't be suggesting we attack the betrayer." "Why not? We've got the Maker in waiting right here, plus me and my army. And as the Maker here reminds me..." "Please call me Carter," he interrupted. "As Carter Strange here reminds me, I've still got my blade. Its edge remains sharp enough to cut the throat of a fallen incarnation." Chapter 31 Haunting. Raoul of Ruck. "I'm dead," Raoul thought. Not that he cared especially. Concerns seemed far from him. Probably it was the nonchalance the dead were famous for, he mused. All around him it was black. Well, not so much black as void. if nothingness could be said to have a color. People, even people in Ruck, imagined the void of space as black, and in the universe of normal matter where things like photons and optical nerves were real, perhaps darkness really was black in outer space from a certain perspective. From Raoul's current point of view, optic nerves and photons were distant concepts. He was, he reminded himself a second time, dead. Another thought occurred to him. Thoughts don't normally occur to the dead. Maybe he wasn't, actually. Nope. He was dead. As they say on Earth, as a doornail. Jason Cole, war, had done it for him. He'd perished before he could use a curative cipher or the one that might have removed him from harm's way by flying him straight out of Mageddon. He was no longer alive, it was true. But he was also in Ardeen, which made all the difference. The rules worked differently in the land of the cursed than on Earth or in Ruck or any other recursion Raoul had personally visited. As policy, Ruck's quiet cabal rarely traveled to fictionally or mythologically seated recursions around Earth out of fear of igniting the spark of cognizance in the inhabitants, and that went double for recursions created by fictions that included spirits that survived bodily death. Those were the sort of stories likely to contain beings of magical power, including all manner of demons, demigods, and probably even deities. No one wanted to risk one of those creatures gaining the spark, and worse, becoming quickened. But here he was, in this surprise recursion of Ardeen, which should never have been, where the soul survived bodily death. He was proof. Raoul was glad that ghosts didn't have emotions, otherwise he'd be freaking the hell out, to use another earthly phrase. When he'd first translated to Earth, he'd acquired Spanish automatically, becoming as fluid as a native speaker. He'd had to learn English by dint of concentrated study. Since then, he'd become something of a connoisseur of both languages during his decades-long stay on Earth. He particularly enjoyed the colorful sayings. Not that any of that mattered now. On balance, he was beginning to wonder about his no-emotions assumption. For instance, he obviously retained a sense of curiosity because he wanted to know very badly where he was. And if he was going to be completely truthful about it, he was becoming attached to even the limited existence he still apparently retained, though that paled before the cold worry that soaked through him when he wondered what had become of Catherine Manners.
"Michura," he whispered.
And just like that, the void suddenly spat him out, and he was with Kate. Last time he'd seen her, she'd been in the foundries facing off against war. He'd tried to save her. As a senior agent of Ruck's quiet cabal, Raoul figured he stood a chance against Jason. But in the context of Ardeen, Jason was also war, a demigod of combat. And before an incarnation, Raoul had failed to prevail.
"Raoul," said Kate, as her eyes focused on him. They were red, as if she'd been crying. "I'm so sorry."
He reached to comfort her, but his hand passed right through her shoulder. The sensation was like waving through cool fog. He drew back and studied his hand. It seemed normal enough and solid to him. He wondered how he looked to Kate, ghostly and pale. The fiction made real meant that, yes, that was probably how he looked.
"Where are we?" he asked.
"In a storeroom just off the contact foundry." Burlap-wrapped parcels cluttered the small room. The single exit was barred with a thin metallic rod.
"Kate, staying in the enemy stronghold is foolhardy."
"Tell me about it." "But I don't know where to go." "But we're safe for now. I'm safe anyhow. What about you? You're the one who... died.
Remarkably good, considering.
His voice sounded almost the same to his own ears, other than having acquired a slight resonance. Some might even call it a ghostly resonance. She glanced into his eyes.
Fuck, Raoul. I didn't know what to do. I saw you bleeding out, and before I could really even think about it, the part of me that believes she's part of this world, that shepherds the dead, reached out to you, offered you a place with me. If that was wrong of me, I...
Seriously? He interrupted. She'd provided him a place to anchor. If he concentrated, he could feel a cool current, as if he was standing ankle-deep in icy water. Here with Kate, he knew he could ignore it. But without her, he'd have been swept away into the night vault on a colorless wave of non-existence. He continued,
"If I'd been stabbed that many times in rock or on earth, that would have been the end forever. So, thank you for thinking on your feet and offering a hand. I feel overwhelmingly odd, but that's hardly surprising. And when you think about the alternative,"
he shrugged. Kate scrunched her eyes in sudden thought. She said,
"Hey, is a ghost you enough like the real you to translate back to Earth and arrive as the living version of you?"
He blinked.
"I don't know. I suspect not. But I suppose we could try and see what..."
Kate said, "No. At least not before we look into it further. Do some experiments first, so we don't kill you." She waved her hands as if at some imaginary space where experiments on ghosts and dimensional travel could be conducted. "What if we try and you turn up on Earth as a corpse?"
Raoul nodded. What he understood of context-keeping during translations between recursions hinted that if a dead person translated into a world where standard physics held sway, well, he hoped he'd make a pretty corpse.
He kept his doubts to himself. Instead, he said,
"What do you propose?"
She pointed at her ring. "This is even more important than we first thought. Jason originally sent it to Earth in contravention of everything you've told me about translating. To survive that trip, it had to be something exceptional here in Ardeen. It can move between realms, which is why Jason used it in the first place and why I found it in that server room on Earth."
"Agreed. Usually only ciphers can..."
"I figured out what it really is. One of the rings of incarnation. It's desire." Raoul had acquired enough frame of reference upon translation into Ardeen to know exactly what that meant. If a ghost could gasp, he would have. Kate continued, "And war accidentally woke it for a little while.
It was as if I was the incarnation of desire. I don't remember.
You were dying."
"Ah."
He wanted to clear his throat, but found he lacked the means. Instead, he said,
"So, you're suggesting this incarnation has the means to return to life those recently dead?"
"I don't know, but I'm going to try."
"Wait," urged Raoul, suddenly nervous for a reason he couldn't name. "Where's War? Won't he be back?"
"I don't know. Desire bested him somehow, made him stand down. Then you died and I was distracted. After that, he was gone. Not much time's passed since you reappeared.
5 minutes, maybe." "We need to find out where he is and go somewhere else, so he doesn't turn you into a ghost, too."
She shook her head. "If he shows up again, Desire can handle him."
"Desire? You talk like it's a separate entity. You're wearing the ring. Doesn't that mean you control the power of the incarnation?"
"Sort of. I can't quite explain it." She waved away his question and continued, "It doesn't matter. Let's see if we can do anything for you." He recognized that intractable tone.
"Fine," he said. "But I'm keeping watch. Jason might have left for reasons of his own, but he or one of his duplicates could turn up again at any moment. These foundries are presumably central to his operation."
Kate wasn't listening. She'd raised her hand, the one wearing the ring of desire. Raoul eyed it with newfound wariness. She closed her eyes in concentration. About 10 seconds passed before he realized sapphire and silver flowers just coming into bloom sprouted from the storeroom floor.
Funny that he hadn't noticed them before. The delicate scent of lily of the valley mixed with the nostalgic odor of lilac relaxed him, though he idly wondered how it was he could smell.
The blooms were thickest at Kate's feet, where the petals flowed into a blue gown sewn with silver thread. Had Kate been wearing that all along? If so, he hadn't appreciated how magnificent it was. He'd always known she was wonderful, but now her beauty outshone the sun. Her red hair was a bundle of braids wound about with silver wire, and on her finger sat a wide band that burned with divine grace. His earlier suspicion that spirits in Ardeen could feel emotion was confirmed. At least in the presence of this woman, the emotion of desire transfixed and perhaps would have frozen his heart, had he had one.
"Híjole," Raoul muttered. Spanish was better for expressing surprise than English or Ruckian. Ruck, which was his home, recursion. Right. "What the—"
Raoul startled from his spell. He managed to croak.
"Kate, you in there? That ring of desire is no fooling around."
Desire slowly blinked, and she looked down at her ring, ignoring Raoul completely. She said, her voice both like Catherine's and something far more, "I hear the Maker speaking. His voice is so faint. Oh, praise be to him. He is not slain. War tried, but failed."
"That's good," mumbled Raoul. "But,"
she cocked her head as if straining to hear, "he summons us, all the incarnations. He needs us. We must go to him.
And I am late, too late.
He called days ago, and I tarried unknowing, just as war failed to hear." Her eyes closed. The divine light that had shone down on her from some higher realm faded. Raoul realized there were no flowers, no overpowering floral fragrance, or a god whose presence could madden those who saw her. There was only Kate, who looked confused.
"I wonder if it's wise to call up the power of that incarnation ever again," said Raoul quietly.
"You might be right," said Kate, rubbing her temple. It was hard to push her back this time. "But I learned something. I know where Carter is and where war has gone. Carter's trying to get into the Maker's Hall."
"Carter? He's here?"
"Him, or someone who thinks he's the Maker anyway." Raoul frowned. He said,
"This Maker's Hall, it's like Ardeen's version of Mount Olympus."
Earth mythology was something every agent of the Quiet Cabal learned. It came in handy in knowing what recursions to avoid. "Presumably it's the same place Jason wants to break into to steal the keys to the kingdom, so to speak. And if Desire knows where Carter is, so must War and Jason. He's been trying to accumulate the rings of incarnation for the same purpose, use them to open the Maker's Hall."
"How do you know what Jason's been up to?"
Desire learned much gazing into Jason's eyes. She could read his deepest desires. That's one of her gifts. Kate coughed.
Right. So, if it is Carter, he must have called the Rings of Incarnation because he wants to get into the hall, too. Meanwhile, Jason knows Carter is back in Ardeen, the same way as you?
The same way as Desire just did, yes. If I concentrate, I can still almost feel what Jason is thinking.
Maybe you shouldn't do that, Raoul cautioned.
We need to stop Jason, Kate said. He's planning on overpowering Carter, taking all the rings for himself, and claiming the power of the Maker. Raoul would have felt queasy if he'd had a stomach.
Jason is a psychopath.
He doesn't think any of this is real, Kate said. Plus, bearing one of these rings as long as he has can't have been easy for him.
Regardless, Raoul said, he's got to be stopped. He's at least partially quickened. If he was able to send the Ring of Desire to Earth in the first place, biter or no, if he gained godlike power in Ardeen, he wouldn't be long satisfied in this realm. He'd turn his eyes to Earth. We need to get help.
From where?
From Rook. From those who sent me to the world of normal matter in the first place, the Quiet Cabal.
But you might blink out of existence if you leave Ardeen. Or if I leave, what happens to you? Besides, I don't know the way.
I can tell you what you need to know to translate.
No, you'll die. I'm already dead, Michula. I'm not going to argue about it. We are here, within the context of Ardeen. We have the power to oppose Jason.
He is the betrayer. He's war.
And I can call on Desire. Raoul knew, as he'd known before, that it was futile to keep talking when Kate's tone settled in that particular stubborn pitch. But he offered one last argument.
If the betrayer doesn't kill you, Desire might subsume you. That might be even worse. You'd lose your mind and personality, your soul.
If Jason gains his heart's desire, everyone on Earth will be wiped out or overwritten with clones of Jason's making. It's me or billions. Seems like an easy choice, don't you agree? Raoul didn't want to admit it, but Kate was right. He said,
and if Earth is devoured by Jason, it wouldn't be long before all the recursions that Earth hosts would come to the same end, probably by a breach from the Strange itself. All the limited worlds would be wiped out, including Rook.
So help me, dammit, is there some kind of translational ability that will get me to Carter?
You'd know it if you had something like that. But you got that ring. Can incarnations fly like angels?
Kate blinked. I don't know. I'd have to call her up again to find out.
Wait on that. I might have something.
Raoul pointed at his own corpse, which Kate must have dragged into the antechamber with her. It lay battered, torn, and pale, in a dark bloom of blood. He'd avoided looking until then, just in case the experience didn't sit well. He'd been right to do so. Seeing himself splayed out like meat on a butcher's block was awful. Luckily, he had no time for drama. Kate followed his gesture, moving to the blood's edge. Raoul directed.
Checking my stuff. I carried a couple of ciphers with me from Earth. Grab them both.
Kate bent and removed the pouch from the corpse's belt with quick fingers. Raoul half expected to feel something when she did, through some kind of sympathetic relationship, but apparently the connection between what he'd been before and the ghost he was now was severed. Are these it? Kate dumped a handful of gold coins, a rolled bundle of lock-picking tools, a small dagger, an amulet, and a vial of elixir into her palm.
Raoul said, "Grab the vial and the amulet. The rest is just leftover residue from my translation. They are meaningless."
Kate dumped the coins, keeping the amulet, the vial, and, Raoul noticed, the lock-picking tools. She shoved those into her satchel, then examined the remaining items. Her eyes grew wider.
You know, I can feel that there's something different about these.
Anyone who's quickened has the same ability, Raoul explained. The ability to sense objects birthed in the strange, like ciphers. Stow the vial. It's the amulet we want.
Should I put it on? Without thinking, he reached for it to show her how to activate the function. His hand passed through her and amulet.
Better just tell me how it works, she said.
It's an instant shield, Raoul said. It has a special traveling property. I've been itching to try it out, truth to tell. Put on the amulet, then press the circular image on the front with the wing design.
Kate lifted the chain over her neck.
What's going to happen?
You'll gain the means to rapidly travel, he said. I don't know the specifics, but that's how ciphers work.
Then you better tuck in. I don't want to leave you behind. Kate raised the ring of incarnation. It's your new focus until we figure out how to translate you back to life. Raoul glanced one last time at his corpse. He hoped Kate's confidence wasn't misplaced. Then he allowed himself to disincorporate. The void claimed him once more, except now that he knew his situation, he found that he wasn't actually in a place of emptiness. Concentrating, Raoul recognized that he remained with Kate, except he was bodiless and without form. It was like he was haunting her. Everything was a bit fuzzy, but he could still sense what was going on around her. Kate examined the amulet a few more moments, glanced at the corpse, then away. She mumbled,
"Time to fly the fuck out of here."
She unbarred the door to the antechamber and activated the cipher. A full-sized iron shield popped into existence as the amulet melted away in a mist of fractal designs. Blazoned on the shield's front were feathered dragon wings. Kate flinched away, but the shield remained before her, hovering protectively. She shrugged, then inserted her arm into the straps and said, "Take me to Carter Morrison, where he waits upon the glass desert." The shield warped and grew, reaching to wrap her in a protective envelope of thin iron. In a second, it transformed into a craft that resembled, so far as Raoul could determine, a carved metal dragon. Twin portholes for eyes allowed Kate to look out. She was already cursing in surprise as the enchanted conveyance swept its wings back and rocketed forward on a jet of dragon-heated air. The wing edges struck sparks and terrific echoes from the walls of Mageddon as the craft careened along corridors and up every set of stairs it found, moving higher and higher within the fortress. More than once, homunculi had to throw themselves flat to avoid being splattered across its front. Then they burst free from the structure like an arrow fired from a giant's bow. They sped high above the betrayer's lava-lit citadel of doom, gaining even more velocity. Raoul barely had a moment to take it in. Already the craft was rolling into a new trajectory. A mirror-bright line of radiance blazed on the horizon, with obscenities spewing in their wake from a thoroughly rattled Catherine Manners, the craft winged west towards the eye-watering glow. Chapter 32 Shortcut. Jason Cole. The moment Desire's attention lifted, Jason fled from Mageddon's foundries like a cockroach let out from beneath a glass. He didn't race along the corridors of his fortress out of fear. He wasn't afraid of Desire. Exactly the opposite. But events of the prior minutes had convinced him that no matter whether he addressed Desire while wearing the aura of war, or as merely Jason the Betrayer, he was vulnerable. Whatever affair the two incarnations had enjoyed in their fictional relationship before he'd stepped into the office of war was a chink in his armor he couldn't repair. At least, not without due preparation. Preparation he'd just discovered he had no time for. While he stood bedazzled by Desire's divine smile, War heard Carter Strange call for the rings of incarnation. Jason's metallic oversized boots clanged on the stone stairs as he sprinted up to the aerie. He was delighted to find the Dlama hadn't left for wherever it called home. The creature had landed Jason there less than an hour before. Two red homunculi were wiping it down. Evidence of a repast was spread out on the stone, red and rare, like the Dlama preferred. "Are you rested?" Jason asked. "I need your help again. Something has happened. Desire is here. Can you believe it? She's incarnate. Though that's not what I need your help with. Still, I can't help wondering," the Dlama said. "You are babbling." Jason counted to five. He congratulated himself on his self-discipline for not smashing the flying thing into paste for its impertinence. He concentrated on all the fond thoughts he'd recently entertained regarding the winged beast. He said, "Allow me to rephrase," he said. "Please fly me to the center of the glass desert immediately, will you?" The Dlama regarded Jason for several long seconds with its expression unreadable behind its mask. It finally replied, "I need a restorative more vital than this meal." Its eyes flicked to the red mess. "But yes, I sense you would not ask were the need not urgent." "Urgent," he coughed, catching himself yet again. "Yes, that's exactly right." Jason removed from his belt an elixir, one of the special class of potions and similar trinkets that turned up unexpectedly now and again. "I'll spare you the details, if you're not interested," he continued, handing over the vial. The Dlama grasped it in surprisingly dexterous feathers and sucked the vial dry. A shimmer of vibrancy flowed across its wings and tail feathers, and its eyes sparkled. After that, it bowed, allowing Jason to mount. As he secured himself with leather straps into the saddle, Jason explained, "Suffice it to say that a sad pretender to the Maker's power is back in play, and we need to work swiftly to stay in the game." The Dlama leaped, wings fanning out. They were back in the air. Instead of flying west, the creature winged straight south. As Jason opened his mouth to make the obvious comment, the Dlama said, "We can cut hours off the trip by skimming along the exterior of Ardeen in the Strange, then re-entering at a point closest to our destination." "We can?" The Dlama continued, "Of course. Remember our homecoming? We talked about this very thing." "Of course," Jason admitted. He was embarrassed to have forgotten. But to be fair to himself, before his trip with Marid, he'd avoided thinking about the Dark Energy Network as policy. "But now that I do remember, why not go up?" he inquired. "Ardeen isn't spherical." "The air is mostly confined to within 10 miles of the surface, true," the Dlama replied. "But the boundary where the Strange begins is much farther above and beneath the landmass than where the air gives out, presumably to leave room for the sun, moons, and all the stars to exist within." "Right," Jason said. He'd occasionally wondered if those celestial objects lay out in the Strange. Apparently not. But it didn't matter. The Dlama was flying. He trusted it to take him where he wanted to go. The creature flapped on, eating up the miles. Sitting on the Dlama's saddle, he could do nothing except think. The borderlands rolled beneath him as they approached the edge. He had some time to consider his situation. He'd been far more reactive of late than he preferred. Events had been pushing him rather than the other way around, and he didn't like it. Jason pulled out the chain on which he kept the two other rings he'd collected besides his own, Death and Commerce. Both were weighty, thick with significance.